As this nation celebrates its 250th anniversary, we're hearing the words of the Declaration of Independence. Among them, the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What do those rights mean? How were they applied when they were written? How are they applied now? One view from Dr. Claudia Kramer, the Scott L. Probasco Distinguished Chair of Free Enterprise at the Gary W. Rollins College of Business here on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. She now writes a monthly column for Business Trend, the email newsletter from the Chattanooga Area Chamber of Commerce. Claudia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
Let's talk about America 250. You recently spoke to teachers from across Tennessee, and you asked them to do something simple.
It was a fun opportunity to teach K through 12 Tennessee teachers that typically teach civics or social studies. And I walk in the room as the economist, and they're like, why is an economist at a civics academy? And so what I was trying to get them to do is just rethink about our founding documents, the founding of this country as we celebrate America's 250 through what I would argue the economic lens, but that I promised them that it wasn't going to be too difficult to get there, which is that all of these rights were the colonists were fighting for, and then the founders embodied in the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, for example, economists really think of them as property rights. And once you make that shift and start viewing everything through the lens of self-ownership, then I think it starts to become a lot easier to see the connections between our freedoms, and instead of bifurcating them into political freedoms versus economic freedoms, that they're all coming from the same philosophical foundation.
And indeed, when in the Declaration of Independence we read life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, at the core of the intent of the pursuit of happiness was property rights.
That's right. So if we think about how do you pursue your own happiness, well, you have to have self-ownership. And that implies that you have, again, what economists would call property rights. So rights over land, labor, and capital. But let's back up for a second and go, well, labor, wait, that's me. So that's what we mean by self-ownership, that you get to pursue what you want within, of course, a system of rules to decide, well, what is it that actually makes you happy? You get to live the life that you want to live. And that can take a variety of forms and shapes. But still underpinning that is this understanding that you own what, again, using our econ jargon, but you own the means of production, or you own yourself. And so you get to decide how you earn a living. And that takes on, again, a variety of different flavors across all individuals in this country. And that is what a market-based system capitalizes on. And actually, that's a good thing because we all have different skill sets and we get to decide how we want to apply them or not. And through that decentralized decision-making is how we see pursuit of happiness combined with economic progress.
Indeed, the grievances that drove the colonies to revolt against the British crown under King George III were property cases.
Yeah, they were largely tax issues. And when you think about, wait, what was their gripe? It's, hey, that's mine. You can't take it. It's in some sense, it doesn't mean that it's not complex or complicated, but it's very elementary. It's like the kids fighting in the sandbox. Hey, you can't take that. That's mine. That's exactly the gripe. I earned that. I've worked hard for that. No, you can't tax it at that level. Or even bigger, I didn't consent. I didn't consent to tell you that I agree with taxation, even if you claim that you're giving me a benefit. That's a major founding point. I think even a major difference is across our country and comparing it with other countries is that that's embedded in the way that we view government's accountability to its citizens.
And the Bill of Rights under the U.S. Constitution that were all enacted in the decade following the start of the American Revolution, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution point back to this concept about property.
Absolutely. So when you start going through the amendments, you see a lot of them are explicitly about property rights. Search and seizure, quartering, or basically the army can't come and just take a bedroom in your house. We don't really think about that as being a possibility, but it was back then. But what that's saying is, hey, I have rights to my property and you as the government do not. And that's where there's a hard line there. And then implicit are other what we would consider still property rights cases with things like free speech or freedom of religion or freedom of association. What that says is in order to exercise fully your rights as a U.S. citizen, we're going to protect private spheres. We're going to allow you to protest, for example. We're going to allow you to say things that maybe I don't want to hear, but we believe in those underlying values because it is fundamentally about this issue of self-ownership and rights.
Something else is also true here. As we know, multiple things can be true at once. Mm-hmm. As you write, the principle that you're talking about here was right, but it was not at first applied to everyone.
That's right. So I think it is important to make the distinction about the principles, as you said, but then also the in practice, what happened? Well, no, these rules and rights and regulations governing society did not get applied equally. So we still were in a situation of slavery. So slavery wouldn't end for much later. And then also the rights weren't equally applied to women. And so it doesn't undermine the principle.
And also, if you were a male of European descent, but you did not own property.
That's right.
You were shut out as well.
That's right. We can talk about why the negotiation processes that happened, that's how it got applied initially. And then it did take a while to get universal. But that doesn't undermine the principle and the importance and the kind of the theory behind why these concepts are so important.
And that's why we also have to talk about not only the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution as a whole, but the amendments, the three amendments, the Reconstruction amendments that flowed after the Civil War and were added to the Constitution.
That's right. So whenever we think about the Emancipation Proclamation, the words used and expressed in that, and then the Reconstruction Acts, it was all about specifying, wait, this is going to apply to more people than how it's been applied in practice. Ending slavery is the ultimate restoration of self-ownership. And it still took a while for that to fully take hold. And then it still took a while for freed individuals to be able to have self-ownership in terms of their economic means. So for them to be able to own land or start a business, for example. We definitely don't have a perfect history. But I think it's actually important to talk about in the context of how economists view it through the lens of rights and property rights.
Because as you write, the promise of 1776 and the work of 1865 are not in tension. The second is the keeping of the first.
That's right. It's like we're finally getting there. It took us a while, but we're finally getting there.
And even where we've got more to go, we're pointing in the right direction.
Correct. So that is exactly how I would interpret it, which is why right now it's such a moment to celebrate, is the founding has it correct in terms of, again, the arguments, the philosophy, the core foundational values, and for a variety of reasons that really do underpin the way that we want to exist and self-govern in our own country. And again, in practice, it has not been perfect. So it's not to ignore the mistakes that we've made, but to keep coming back to, look, the Constitution says this. The Bill of Rights provide these rights, and they need to be enforced and universally applied.
And two documents have the year 1776 in common, the Declaration of Independence and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And the two, you say, go together.
I would argue that Jefferson had to be reading Smith. Whenever we look at some of the, again, the arguments, so even if you would pull in the Federalist Papers, the way that these values, the way that these rights are being articulated are heavily pulling from the Enlightenment period and also pulling from writers such as Adam Smith, who was providing really the kind of core economic modern theory of what we think of in terms of understanding the benefits of providing you property rights to be able to, in some sense, do what you want. But by you doing what you want, you benefit me. And by me doing what I want, I benefit you. So that's largely now what we refer to as the invisible hand. And so those sorts of arguments from both the John Locke perspective, philosophical argument of a natural rights combined with Adam Smith's economic arguments for property rights are completely embedded and are flowing through our founding.
As you write, the founders' deepest insight was that the question of who governs matters far less than the question of what governing they are permitted to do by us, by the people.
Yes, it's we are ultimately the ones that are to hold government accountable. And I think it's just an important reminder that we as individual citizens get to say if it's right or wrong, and we have means through rule of law. Might be a clunky process at times, but to say, hey, you overstepped or you're overstepping, or we have separation of powers, for example, for reasons, and we want to see those separations more enforced, for example.
You conclude the best way to honor the founders at America 250 is to understand what they built, to teach it, and to keep it. You need all three.
Yeah, I think in order to understand a way of keeping our rights, protecting those rights, why they're so important is we have to talk about it and we have to have a better understanding. That's, again, why I was so excited to be able to teach these K-12 teachers. They are on the front lines in teaching our students about America's 250. And again, it's not to gloss over any of the negative or parts that we're not proud of. It's to actually learn from it. And that will enable us to keep these rights and to keep our freedoms, to be able to self-govern, to have limited government, to have separation of powers, rule of law, and ultimately for you to be able to live that life you want to live, to pursue happiness however you see fit.
And for people who want to check out your latest column, The Exchange, from the Chattanooga Area Chamber of Commerce, and all your columns there, people can go online to chattanoogachamber.com. Claudia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Catch all our conversations on Scenic Routes at our website, WUTC.org, on the WUTC app, and wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Scenic Routes. More in a moment.